Chapter 15.
Usually I'm pretty mild. In fact, many of my friends are kind enough to call it folksy when I'm writing or speechifying. My ambition is to live by the side of the road and be a friend to man. But I hope that none of the gentlemen who have honored me with their enmity think for one single moment that when I run into a gross enough public evil or a persistent enough detractor, I can't get up on my hind legs and make a sound like a two-tailed grizzly in April. So right at the start of this account of my 10-year fight with them as private citizen, state senator, and U.S. senator, let me say that the Sangfree River Light Power and Fuel Corporation are, and I invite a suit for libel, the meanest, lowest, cowardliest gang of yellow-livered, back-slapping, hypocritical gun-toters, bomb-throwers, ballot-stealers, ledger-fakers, givers of bribes, suborners of perjury, scab-hirers, and general low-down crooks, liars, and swindlers that ever tried to do an honest servant of the people out of an election. Not but what I've always succeeded in licking them, so that my indignation at these homicidal kleptomaniacs is not personal, but entirely on behalf of the general public. 0 hour, Berzelius Windrip. On Wednesday, January 6th, 1937, just a fortnight before his inauguration, President-elect Windrip announced his appointments of cabinet members and of diplomats. Secretary of State, his former secretary and press agent, Lee Saracen, who also took the position of High Marshal or Commander-in-Chief of the Minutemen, which organization was to be established permanently as an innocent marching club. Secretary of the Treasury, one Webster R. Skittle, president of the prosperous Fur and Hide National Bank of St. Louis. Mr. Skittle had once been indicted on a charge of defrauding the government on his income tax, but he had been acquitted more or less, and during the campaign he was said to have taken a convincing way of showing his faith in Buzz Windrip as the savior of the forgotten men. Secretary of War, Colonel Osceola Luthorn, formerly editor of the Topeka, Kansas Argus and the Fancy Goods and Novelties Gazette. More recently, high in real estate. His title came from his position on the honorary staff of the governor of Tennessee. He had long been a friend and fellow campaigner of Windrip. It was a universal regret that Bishop Paul Peter Prang should have refused the appointment as Secretary of War, with a letter in which he called Windrip "my dear friend and collaborator," and asserted that he had actually meant it when he had said he desired no office. Later, it was a similar regret when Father Coughlin refused the ambassadorship to Mexico, with no letter at all, but only a telegram cryptically stating, "just 6 months too late." A new cabinet position, that of Secretary of Education and Public Relations, was created. Not for months would Congress investigate the legality of such a creation, but meantime the new post was brilliantly held by Hector McGoblin, M.D., Ph.D., Honorary Doctor of Letters. Senator Porkwood graced the position of Attorney General, and all the other offices were acceptably filled by men who, though they had roundly supported Windrip's almost socialistic projects for the distribution of excessive fortunes, were yet known to be thoroughly sensible men and no fanatics. It was said, though Doremus Jessup could never prove it, that Windrip learned from Lee Saracen the Spanish custom of getting rid of embarrassing friends and enemies by appointing them to posts abroad, preferably quite far abroad. Anyway, as ambassador to Brazil, Windrip appointed Herbert Hoover, who not very enthusiastically accepted. As ambassador to Germany, Senator Bora. As governor of the Philippines, Senator Robert La Follette, who refused, and as ambassadors to the Court of St. James's, France and Russia, none other than Upton Sinclair, Milo Reno, and Senator Bilbo of Mississippi. These three had a fine time. Mr. Sinclair pleased the British by taking so friendly an interest in their politics that he openly campaigned for the Independent Labor Party and issued a lively brochure called I, Upton Sinclair, prove that Prime Minister Walter Elliott, Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden, and First Lord of the Admiralty Nancy Astor are all liars and have refused to accept my freely offered advice. Mr. Sinclair also aroused considerable interest in British domestic circles by advocating an act of Parliament forbidding the wearing of evening clothes and all hunting of foxes except with shotguns. And on the occasion of his official reception at Buckingham Palace, he warmly invited King George and Queen Mary to come and live in California. Mr. Milo Reno, insurance salesman and former president of the National Farm Holiday Association, whom all the French royalists compared to his great predecessor, Benjamin Franklin, for forthrightness, became the greatest social favorite in the international circles of Paris, the Basses-Pyrénées, and the Riviera, and was once photographed playing tennis at Antibes with the Duc de Tropez, Lord Rothermere, and Dr. Rudolf Hess. Senator Bilbo had possibly the best time of all. Stalin asked his advice, as based on his ripe experience in the Gleichschaltung of Mississippi, about the cultural organization of the somewhat backward natives of Tajikistan. And so valuable did it prove that Excellency Bilbo was invited to review the Moscow military celebration the following November 7th, in the same stand with the very highest class of representatives of the classless state. It was a triumph for His Excellency. Generalissimo Voroshilov fainted after 200,000 Soviet troops, 7,000 tanks and 9,000 aeroplanes had passed by. Stalin had to be carried home after reviewing 317,000, but Ambassador Bilbo was there in the stand when the very last of the 626,000 soldiers had gone by, all of them saluting him under the quite erroneous impression that he was the Chinese ambassador, and he was still tirelessly returning their salutes, 14 to the minute, and softly singing with them the International. He was less of a hit later, however, when to the unsmiling Anglo-American Association of Exiles to Soviet Russia from Imperialism, he sang to the tune of the International what he regarded as amusing private words of his own. Arise, ye prisoners of starvation, from Russia make your getaway. They all are rich in Bilbo's nation. God bless the USA. Mrs. Adelaide Targimich, after her spirited campaign for Mr. Windrup, was publicly angry that she was offered no position higher than a post in the customs office in Nome, Alaska, though this was offered to her very urgently indeed. She had demanded that there be created, especially for her, the cabinet position of Secretariess of Domestic Science, Child Welfare, and Anti-Vice. She threatened to turn Jeffersonian, Republican, or Communistic, but in April she was heard of in Hollywood, writing the scenario for a giant picture to be called They Did It in Greece. As an insult and boy-from-home joke, the president-elect appointed Franklin D. Roosevelt minister to Liberia. Mr. Roosevelt's opponents laughed very much, and opposition newspapers did cartoons of him, sitting unhappily in a grass hut with a sign on which NRA had been crossed out and USA substituted. But Mr. Roosevelt declined with so amiable a smile that the joke seemed rather to have slipped. The followers of President Windrup trumpeted that it was significant that he should be the first president inaugurated not on March 4th, but on January 20th, according to the provision of the new 20th Amendment to the Constitution. It was a sign straight from heaven, though actually heaven had not been the author of the amendment, but Senator George W. Norris of Nebraska, and proved that Windrup was starting a new paradise on earth. The inauguration was turbulent. President Roosevelt declined to be present. He politely suggested that he was about half ill unto death, but that same noon he was seen in a New York shop, buying books on gardening and looking abnormally cheerful. More than 1,000 reporters, photographers, and radio men covered the inauguration. 27 constituents of Senator Porkwood, of all sexes, had to sleep on the floor of the senator's office, and a hall bedroom in the suburb of Bladensburg rented for $30 for 2 nights. The presidents of Brazil, the Argentine, and Chile flew to the inauguration in a Pan American aeroplane, and Japan sent 700 students on a special train from Seattle. A motor company in Detroit had presented to Windrip a limousine with armor plate, bulletproof glass, a hidden nickel steel safe for papers, a concealed private bar, and upholstery made from the Toisson tapestries of 1670. But Buzz chose to drive from his home to the capital in his old Hupmobile sedan, and his driver was a youngster from his hometown, whose notion of a uniform for state occasions was a blue serge suit, red tie, and derby hat. Windrip himself did wear a topper, but he saw to it that Lee Saracen saw to it that the 130 million plain citizens learned, by radio, even while the inaugural parade was going on, that he had borrowed the topper for this one sole occasion from a New York Republican representative who had ancestors. But following Windrip was an un-Jacksonian escort of soldiers, the American Legion, and, immensely grander than the others, the Minutemen, wearing trench helmets of polished silver, and led by Colonel Dewey Hake in scarlet tunic and yellow riding breeches and helmet with golden plumes. Solemnly, for once looking a little awed, a little like a small-town boy on Broadway, Windrip took the oath administered by the Chief Justice, who disliked him very much indeed, and, edging even closer to the microphone, squawked, "My fellow citizens, as the President of the United States of America, I want to inform you that the real New Deal has started right this minute, and we're all going to enjoy the manifold liberties to which our history entitles us, and have a whale of a good time doing it. I thank you." That was his first act as president. His second was to take up residence in the White House, where he sat down in the East Room in his stocking feet and shouted at Lee Saracen, "This is what I've been planning to do now for 6 years. I bet this is what Lincoln used to do. Now let him assassinate me." His third, in his role as commander-in-chief of the army, was to order that the Minutemen be recognized as an unpaid but official auxiliary of the regular army, subject only to their own officers, to Buzz, and to High Marshal Saracen, and that rifles, bayonets, automatic pistols, and machine guns be instantly issued to them by government arsenals. That was at 4 p.m. Since 3 p.m., all over the country, bands of MMs had been sitting gloating over pistols and guns, twitching with desire to seize them. Fourth coup was a special message next morning to Congress, in session since January 4th, the third having been a Sunday, demanding the instant passage of a bill embodying point 15 of his election platform, that he should have complete control of legislation and execution, and the Supreme Court be rendered incapable of blocking anything that it might amuse him to do. By joint resolution, with less than half an hour of debate, both houses of Congress rejected that demand before 3 p.m. on January 21st. Before 6, the president had proclaimed that a state of martial law existed during the present crisis, and more than 100 congressmen had been arrested by Minutemen on direct orders from the president. The congressmen who were hot-headed enough to resist were cynically charged with inciting to riot. They who went quietly were not charged at all. It was blandly explained to the agitated press by Lee Saracen that these latter quiet lads had been so threatened by irresponsible and seditious elements that they were merely being safeguarded. Saracen did not use the phrase protective arrest, which might have suggested things. To the veteran reporters, it was strange to see the titular Secretary of State, theoretically a person of such dignity and consequence that he could deal with the representatives of foreign powers, acting as press agent and yes-man for even the president. There were riots, instantly, all over Washington, all over America. The recalcitrant congressman had been penned in the district jail. Toward it, in the winter evening, marched a mob that was noisily mutinous toward the Windrip for whom so many of them had voted. Among the mob buzzed hundreds of Negroes, armed with knives and old pistols, for one of the kidnapped congressmen was a Negro from Georgia, the first colored Georgian to hold high office since carpetbagger days. Surrounding the jail behind machine guns, the rebels found a few regulars, many police, and a horde of minutemen. But at these last they jeered, calling them Minnie Mouses and tin soldiers and mama's boys. The MMs looked nervously at their officers and at the regulars who were making so professional a pretense of not being scared. The mob heaved bottles and dead fish. Half a dozen policemen with guns and nightsticks, trying to push back the van of the mob, were buried under a human surf and came up grotesquely battered and ununiformed, those who ever did come up again. There were two shots, and one minute man slumped to the jail steps, another stood ludicrously holding a wrist that spurted blood. The minutemen, why, they said to themselves, they'd never meant to be soldiers anyway, just wanted to have some fun marching. They began to sneak into the edges of the mob, hiding their uniform caps. That instant, from a powerful loudspeaker in a lower window of the jail, brayed the voice of President Berzelius Windrip. "I am addressing my own boys, the Minutemen, everywhere in America. To you and you only, I look for help to make America a proud, rich land again. You have been scorned. They thought you were the lower classes. They wouldn't give you jobs. They told you to sneak off like bums and get relief. They ordered you into lousy CCC camps. They said you were no good because you were poor. I tell you that you are, ever since yesterday noon, the highest lords of the land, the aristocracy, the makers of the new America of freedom and justice. Boys, I need you. Help me. Help me to help you. Stand fast. Anybody tries to block you, give the swine the point of your bayonet." A machine gunner MM who had listened reverently let loose. The mob began to drop, and into the backs of the wounded as they went staggering away, the MM infantry, running, poked their bayonets. Such a juicy squash it made, and the fugitives looked so amazed, so funny as they tumbled in grotesque heaps. The MMs hadn't, in dreary hours of bayonet drill, known this would be such sport. They'd have more of it now. And hadn't the President of the United States himself told each of them, personally, that he needed their aid? When the remnants of Congress ventured to the Capitol, they found it seated with MMs, while a regiment of regulars under Major General Meineke paraded the grounds. The Speaker of the House and the Honorable Mr. Perley Beecroft, Vice President of the United States and Presiding Officer of the Senate, had the power to declare that quorums were present. If a lot of members chose to dally in the district jail, enjoying themselves instead of attending Congress, whose fault was that? Both houses passed a resolution declaring Point 15 temporarily in effect during the crisis. The legality of the passage was doubtful, but just who was to contest it? Even though the members of the Supreme Court had not been placed under protective arrest, merely confined each to his own house by a squad of minutemen. Bishop Paul Peter Prang had, his friends said afterward, been dismayed by Windrip's stroke of state. Surely, he complained, Mr. Windrip hadn't quite remembered to include Christian Amity in the program he had taken from the League of Forgotten Men. Though Mr. Prang had contentedly given up broadcasting ever since the victory of justice and fraternity in the person of Berzelius Windrip, he wanted to caution the public again. But when he telephoned to his familiar station, WLFM in Chicago, the manager informed him that, just temporarily, all access to the air was forbidden, except as it was especially licensed by the offices of Lee Saracen. Oh, that was only one of 16 jobs that Lee and his 600 new assistants had taken on in the past week. Rather timorously, Bishop Prang motored from his home in Persepolis, Indiana, to the Indianapolis airport and took a night plane for Washington, to reprove, perhaps even playfully to spank, his naughty disciple, Buzz. He had little trouble in being admitted to see the president. In fact, he was, the press feverishly reported, at the White House for 6 hours, though whether he was with the president all that time they could not discover. At 3 in the afternoon, Prang was seen to leave by a private entrance to the executive offices and take a taxi. They noted that he was pale and staggering. In front of his hotel, he was elbowed by a mob who, in curiously unmenacing and mechanical tones, yelped, "Lynch 'em! Down at the enemy's Windrup!" A dozen MMs pierced the crowd and surrounded the bishop. The ensign commanding them bellowed to the crowd so that all might hear, "You cowards, leave the bishop alone! Bishop, come with us, and we'll see you're safe." Millions heard on their radios that evening the official announcement that to ward off mysterious plotters, probably Bolsheviks, Bishop Prang had been safely shielded in the district jail, and with it a personal statement from President Windrup that he was filled with joy at having been able to rescue from the foul agitators my friend and mentor, Bishop P.P. Prang, than whom there is no man living who I so admire and respect. There was, as yet, no absolute censorship of the press, only a confused imprisonment of journalists who offended the government or local officers of the MMs, and the papers chronically opposed to Windrup carried by no means flattering hints that Bishop Prang had rebuked the president and been plain jailed, with no nonsense about a rescue. These mutters reached Persepolis. Not all the Persepolitans ached with love for the bishop or considered him a modern St. Francis, gathering up the little fowls of the fields in his handsome LaSalle car. There were neighbors who hinted that he was a window-peeping snooper after bootleggers and obliging grass widows. But proud of him, their best advertisement, they certainly were, and the Persepolis Chamber of Commerce had caused to be erected at the eastern gateway to Main Street the sign, "Home of Bishop Prang, Radio's Greatest Star." So as one man, Persepolis telegraphed to Washington, demanding Prang's release, but a messenger in the executive offices, who was a Persepolis boy, he was, it is true, a colored man, but suddenly he became a favorite son, lovingly remembered by old schoolmates, tipped off the mayor that the telegrams were among the hundredweight of messages that were daily hauled away from the White House unanswered. Then a quarter of the citizenry of Persepolis mounted a special train to march on Washington. It was one of those small incidents which the opposition press could use as a bomb under Windrup, and the train was accompanied by a score of high-ranking reporters from Chicago, and later from Pittsburgh, Baltimore, and New York. While the train was on its way, and it was curious what delays and sidetrackings it encountered, a company of Minutemen at Logansport, Indiana, rebelled against having to arrest a group of Catholic nuns who were accused of having taught treasonably. High Marshal Saracen felt that there must be a lesson early and impressive. A battalion of MMs sent from Chicago in fast trucks arrested the mutinous company and shot every third man. When the Persepolitans reached Washington, they were tearfully informed by a brigadier of MMs who met them at the Union Station that poor Bishop Prang had been so shocked by the treason of his fellow Indianans that he had gone melancholy mad, and they had tragically been compelled to shut him up in St. Elizabeth's government insane asylum. No one willing to carry news about him ever saw Bishop Prang again. The brigadier brought greetings to the Persepolitans from the president himself, and an invitation to stay at the Willard at government expense. Only a dozen accepted. The rest took the first train back, not amiably, and from then on there was one town in America in which no MM ever dared to appear in his ducky forage cap and dark blue tunic. The chief of staff of the regular army had been deposed. In his place was Major General Emanuel Coon. Doremus and his like were disappointed by General Coon's acceptance, for they had always been informed, even by the nation, that Emanuel Coon, though a professional army officer who did enjoy a fight, preferred that that fight be on the side of the Lord, that he was generous, literate, just, and a man of honor. And honor was the one quality that Buzz Windrip wasn't even expected to understand. Rumor said that Coon, as Nordic a Kentuckian as ever existed, a descendant of men who had fought beside Kit Carson and Commodore Perry, was particularly impatient with the puerility of anti-Semitism, and that nothing so pleased him as, when he heard new acquaintances being superior about the Jews, to snarl, "Did you by any chance happen to notice that my name is Emmanuel Coon, and that Coon might be a corruption of some name rather familiar on the east side of New York?" "Oh, well, I suppose even General Coon feels orders are orders," sighed Doremus. President Windrip's first extended proclamation to the country was a pretty piece of literature and of tenderness. He explained that powerful and secret enemies of American principles, one rather gathered that they were a combination of Wall Street and Soviet Russia, upon discovering to their fury that he, Berzelius, was going to be president, had planned their last charge. Everything would be tranquil in a few months, but meantime there was a crisis during which the country must bear with him. He recalled the military dictatorship of Lincoln and Stanton during the Civil War, when civilian suspects were arrested without warrant. He hinted how delightful everything was going to be. "Right away now, just a moment's patience," when he had things in hand. And he wound up with a comparison of the crisis to the urgency of a fireman rescuing a pretty girl from a conflagration and carrying her down a ladder for her own sake, whether she liked it or not, and no matter how appealingly she might kick her pretty ankles. The whole country laughed. "Great card, that, Buzz, but mighty competent guy," said the electorate. "I should worry whether Bish Prang or any other nut is in the booby hatch, long as I get my $5,000 a year like Windrip promised," said Shad Ledoux to Charlie Betts, the furniture man. It had all happened within the 8 days following Windrip's inauguration. Chapter 16.